And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, www.freakradio.org. Want to suggest that you have a pencil and paper handy, because there might just be something you want to write down. Some web page, some email address, some place to donate, some place to go, some action to take. You might want to just take some notes here. You can be a more effective activist if you're organized. Let's start off with the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. They write, "This week, no wild buffalo were killed because there currently aren't any wild buffalo in Montana. It feels like the calm before the storm. The buffalo will come. Deep winter snows and ancient instincts will push them into lower elevations into Montana. And when they do, hunters will converge along the boundaries of Yellowstone National Park to shoot them. Most of the hunters will come, make their kills, and go, leaving only gut piles in their wake. Many buffalo hunters aren't aware that outside of hunting season, wild buffalo aren't allowed in Montana, or that thousands are slaughtered from within and around Yellowstone National Park. Many hunters come to take from the buffalo without giving anything in return." A few years ago, before she passed away, Buffalo Field Campaign co-founder Lakota Elder Rosalie Little Thunder said, "We have a relationship with the buffalo. It sustains us. But we owe not only the buffalo, but the earth quite a lot. It's not about what we get, but about what we have to give back." As you so often do, hunters should give back to the buffalo, give them voice, work to increase their numbers, advocate for them to live as indigenous wildlife, fulfilling their ecological role on their native landscape. Volunteers, the Buffalo Field Campaign is seeking buffalo warriors for the approaching season. Buffalo Field Campaign has seasonal openings for field volunteers. We have opportunities in every season, but they're in especially great need of folks during the field season, which runs from mid-November through May and is in full swing right now. This is when wild bison are migrating into Montana. Any buffalo within Montana's border is in danger of being shot on sight, hazed, or captured and shipped to a slaughterhouse. All volunteers are provided room, board, gear, and training. We cater to almost any dietary need and yet respect vegan and vegetarian diets. We are located in a warm log cabin by beautiful Hebgen Lake, just a few miles outside of West Yellowstone, Montana, and I know for sure they have a new bathroom and shower. Check the website for details, and we'll see you on the front lines. The Buffalo Field Campaign, their webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. Their address, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. That address again, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. If you have any questions, give them a call. Ask for Mike at 406-646-0070. Tell him Dennis told you to call. The Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And an Ecuadorian indigenous leader is found dead just days before a planned protest at the Lima summit. The story by Jonathan Watts of The Guardian, as found on the Earth First Newswire. The body of an indigenous leader who was opposed to a major mining project in Ecuador has been found bound and buried days before he planned to take his campaign to the climate talks in Lima, Peru. The killing highlights the violence and harassment facing environmental activists in Ecuador. Following the confiscation earlier this week of a bus carrying climate campaigners who planned to denounce President Rafael Correa at the United Nations conference. The victim, Jose Isidro Tendetza Antun, former vice president of the Shuar Federation of Zamora, had been missing since the 28th of November, when he was last seen on his way to a meeting of protesters against the Mirador copper and gold mine. After a tip-off on Tuesday, his son Jorge unearthed the body from a grave marked No Name. The body's arms and legs were trussed with a blue rope. Other members of the community said Tendetza had been offered bribes and had his crops burned in an attempt to remove him from the area. Domingo and Quash, a Shuar leader, said there were signs Tendetsa had been tortured, but the full facts had yet to come to light. He said the family were extremely unhappy with the investigation, and what they said was a reluctance of the authorities to conduct a timely autopsy. His body was beaten, bones were broken, said Anquash. He had been tortured and he was thrown in the river. The mere fact that they buried him before telling us the family is suspicious. Tendetsa had been a prominent critic of Mirador Mine, an open cast pit that has been approved in an area of important biodiversity that is also home to the Shuar, Ecuador's second largest indigenous group. The project is operated by Equa Corriente, originally a Canadian-owned firm that was bought by a Chinese conglomerate, CCRC Tangguan Investments, in 2010. According to the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador, the project will devastate around 450,000 acres of forest. This is a camouflaged crime, said Anquash. In Ecuador, multinational companies are invited by the government and get full state security from the police and the army. The army and the police don't provide protection for the people. They don't defend the Shuar people. They've been bought by the company. The authorities are complicit in this crime, Anquash claimed. They will never tell us the truth, he added. Tendetsa was not just anyone. He was a powerful leader against the company. That's why they knocked down his house and burnt his farm. The government will never give us a response. Justice belongs to them. They call us terrorists, but that doesn't mean we are not going to shut up. Several other Shuar opponents of Mirador have died as a result of the conflict in recent years, including Bosco Wasum in 2009, Freddy Taish in 2013, according to Amazon Watch. An initial autopsy said the circumstances of Tendetsa's death were unclear. Harold Burbano of the human rights organization in Red said there was a suspicion that the killing was related to his work as a land defender. There has been a rise in conflict since the transnational mining company entered the area, significantly increasing the risks faced by community leaders, he said. Tendetsa had planned to condemn the project at a Rights of Nature tribunal organized by NGOs at the climate talks, which are taking place this week at the Peruvian capital. Luis Corral, an advisor to Ecuador's Assembly of the People of the South, an umbrella group for the indigenous federations in southern Ecuador, said that if Tendetsa had been able to travel to the COP20, it would have put in grave doubt the honorability and the image of the Ecuadorian government as a guarantor of the rights of nature. We believe that this murder is part of a pattern of escalating violence against indigenous leaders, which responds to the Ecuadorian government and the company's need to clear the opposition to a mega mining project in the Cordillera del Condor, he said. The state, through the police and the judiciary, is involved in hiding this violent crime because of the elemental irregularities in the proceedings. The body was buried without informing the family, and they weren't allowed to attend the second autopsy. And in Florida, a panther has been killed on a road, which sets a record for panther deaths in this story from Associated Press, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Officials say a Florida panther was killed by a vehicle near Naples in southwest Florida. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission reports that the six-month-old uncollared male was found last Friday in Collier County on Golden Gate Boulevard in Golden Gate Estates. The remains will be taken to a Gainesville facility for a necropsy. This is the 27th Florida panther death of 2014 and the 20th hit by a vehicle. The death marks a new annual record for the number of Florida panthers killed on roads in southern Florida, according to the Naples Daily News. Florida panthers once roamed the entire southeastern United States, but only about 160 remain in the wild. And plans have been halted for widening a highway through the ancient redwoods of Northern California. In this story by Nataline DeLapp of the Environmental Protection Information Center. After years of opposition, Caltrans has rescinded its approvals for a controversial highway widening project that would endanger ancient redwood trees in Richardson Grove State Park along Highway 101 in Humboldt County, California. Conservation groups and local residents this week dismissed a lawsuit they filed in federal court in July in exchange for Caltrans abandoning the project approvals and agreeing to restart the environmental review if the agency chooses to pursue the project. Caltrans has been prohibited from any project construction activities by both a 2012 federal court injunction and a recent state court order. This is an important victory, stopping a nonsensical project that would have done terrible damage to an ancient grove of giant redwoods in our state park, said Jeff Miller of the Center for Biological Diversity. We'll be ready to go back to court if Caltrans decides to pursue the project, and it'll have to completely start over on environmental review and the approval process. Conservation groups and local residents have now won three consecutive lawsuits challenging the Richardson Grove Operational Improvement Project, a proposal that would have cut into and paved over the roots of many of Richardson Grove's ancient redwoods, including some that are 2,000 years old, are 18 feet in diameter, and reach heights of 300 feet. Caltrans has pursued this project solely to benefit passage for oversized commercial trucks. It's time to investigate the huge amount of taxpayer money Caltrans has wasted pursuing this ill-conceived project, said Nataline DeLapp of the Environmental Protection Information Center. Caltrans should have to answer why the agency continues to pour money down the drain pursuing a project that cannot be legally approved. Regulatory agencies and the public will not allow Richardson Grove's ancient trees to be damaged. The latest lawsuit was filed by the Environmental Protection Information Center, the Center for Biological Diversity, Californians for Alternatives to Toxics, Bess Baer, Trisha Lee Lotus, Bruce Edwards, Jeffrey Hedden, and David Spreen. The lawsuit challenged Caltrans' violations of the National Environmental Policy Act, the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, and the Endangered Species Act, and the Administrative Procedure Act. Richardson Grove State Park, where tourists often first encounter large redwoods when heading north on Highway 101, is home to one of the last protected stands of accessible old-growth redwood trees in the world. The park also contains essential habitat for threatened and endangered species such as the northern spotted owl, and its creeks support runs of imperiled salmon and steelhead trout. Caltrans first proposed the highway widening project in 2007. Opposition to the project has grown substantially, led by the Save Richardson Grove Coalition, a diverse group of community members including economists, business owners, scientists, and Northern California tribes with long-standing ties to the grove. Caltrans claimed the highway widening project was needed to accommodate large truck travel, but acknowledged that the portion of the road in question was already designated for larger trucks and did not have significant safety problems. The agency did not establish that the project was necessary for safety or would benefit the local economy. Smaller-sized commercial trucks have traveled through the grove for years to deliver goods to Humboldt County, and legislative exemptions have functioned to allow the passage of oversized trucks. The plaintiffs first sued in 2010 when Caltrans certified inadequate environmental review documents and adopted a finding of no significant impact. In 2012, a federal court stopped the project, citing numerous errors in Caltrans's mapping and measurements of affected old-growth redwoods, and stated that the agency had been arbitrary and capricious in its use of what the court called faulty data. The California Court of Appeal in January of 2014 ordered Caltrans to reevaluate the environmental impacts of the project under state law, finding that it had failed to fully assess the impacts on ancient redwoods or provide measures to reduce potentially severe harm to the trees. For more information, visit the website www.wildcalifornia.org. That's www.wildcalifornia.org. And congressional writers are gutting sage-grouse protections in this story by Steve Homer of the American Bird Conservancy. The American Bird Conservancy says the two recent congressional actions will thwart West Side efforts to protect iconic grouse species, the greater and Gunnison sage-grouse, and may eventually doom the birds. The House and Senate leadership announced that Congress expects to enact an omnibus appropriations bill for fiscal year 2015, containing a rider that would prevent, at least temporarily, funding that would make an endangered species list decision on greater sage-grouse possible. It would also hamstring conservation progress on the Gunnison sage-grouse, which was just granted Endangered Species Act protection in November. In another action that could undermine recovery of sage-grouse, the House last week passed a defense authorization bill that is soon expected to become law. A rider attached to the bill effectively waives conservation measures associated with livestock grazing across large tracts of grouse habitat on public lands. These actions shamelessly circumvent science-driven wildlife protection laws, said Steve Homer, senior policy advisor for the American Bird Conservancy. Recent history shows that these riders, once accepted, often become permanent. President Obama should veto these bills and insist that the grouse riders be removed. For the Gunnison and bi-state populations of greater sage grouse, this is a potentially devastating setback. These very small populations should be listed as endangered and given the full protection of the Endangered Species Act. Sage grouse populations crashed while politicians delayed ESA protection for over a decade. Further delay will only dim prospects for the species to recover. The American Bird Conservancy and partners have been working in support of a science-based regional planning initiative for greater sage grouse since 2009 and believe it offers the best path forward to stabilize grouse populations and to leave a legacy of protected wide-open spaces across the West. Unfortunately, the science-driven process appears to have been trumped by political maneuverings that may undercut this massive conservation effort and eventually doom these remarkable birds, Mr. Homer said. And for more information, go to www.abcbirds.org. That's abcbirds.org. And here in California, an Inyo County man has been arrested and charged with poaching deer in this story by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. California Department of Fish and Wildlife officers arrested a poacher recently in Inyo County for allegedly illegally killing a trophy 3x3 deer in the G3 zone. Joseph Eugene Bragdon, 37, of Bishop, California, was taken into custody without incident at his workplace after a $15,000 arrest warrant was issued by the Inyo County District Attorney's Office. We are grateful to the Inyo County DA for recognizing the importance of resource protection and that wildlife poaching is a serious crime, said Lieutenant Bill Daly of the California Department of Fish and Wildlife's Law Enforcement Division. Ethical hunters prize the G3 tag for the incredible landscape and quantity of large deer. With only 35 tags issued every year, hunters can apply for years and never draw a tag for this zone. California Department of Fish and Wildlife officers received a tip through the Cal Tip hotline that on November 1st, Bragdon took his juvenile son to Division Creek in the Trophy G3 hunting zone and killed a large mule deer buck using a D7 deer zone tag. With the assistance of the investigating warden's tracking dog, Seeger, they located a dead deer with only the antlers and part of the edible meat removed. Most of the animal was left to waste. Poaching a deer, cutting the head off, and wasting edible meat is illegal in California and an egregious violation of ethical hunting standards. Wildlife officers took a DNA sample and seized ballistic evidence from the deer remains. The G3 deer season runs only from December 6th through the 21st. The area is considered a trophy deer hunt when high country mule deer bucks enter the area to escape the high country winter storms. In November 2012, Bragdon was convicted of two misdemeanor hunting violations in Nevada, including hunting big game in a closed season and hunting big game without a tag. He was fined and had demerit points added to his Nevada hunting license. Bragdon faces possible charges for several violations of the Fish and Game Code, including taking a deer without a license, tag, or permit, failure to fill out tags, waste of game, failure to have a tag in possession, and possession of less than amounts of marijuana. If convicted, Bragdon could face revocation of his hunting license, fines, probation, and/or jail time. CalTIP, Californians Turn In Poachers and Polluters, is a confidential secret witness program that encourages the public to provide the California Department of Fish and Wildlife with factual information leading to the arrest of poachers and polluters. Ethical hunters and anglers are the most common contributors to the CalTIP hotline. The toll-free hotline number is 888-334-2258. That's 888-334-2258. If you want more information about this, you can contact the California Department of Fish and Wildlife at www.wildlife.ca.gov. That's wildlife.ca.gov. And why killing wolves might not save livestock in this story by Warren Cornwall, writing for the National Geographic and found on the Earth First Newswire. In late August, a government sharpshooter in a helicopter hovering above a wooded eastern Washington hillside killed the lead female wolf of the Huckleberry Pack. The aim was to end attacks by the wolf pack, which had killed more than 24 sheep. But in the long run, a shooting like this could just make matters worse. A new study has found that, paradoxically, killing a wolf can increase the risk that wolves will prey on livestock in the future. The research published recently in the scientific journal PLOS-1 flies in the face of the common idea that the swiftest and surest way to deal with wolves threatening livestock is by shooting them. It adds to a growing understanding of how humans influence the complex dynamics driving these pack animals, sometimes with unexpected consequences. As wolves spread across the West, triggering more encounters with sheep and cattle, and as two states host wolf hunting seasons, the new research also adds more fuel to an already heated political debate about how to deal with wolves. The livestock industry, they're not going to be happy with this, said Rob Wilgus, a Washington State University ecologist and the study's lead author. Shooting wolves is a long-standing practice in the ranching world. It helped lead to the animal's eradication in the western United States in the 1930s. Since the wolf's reintroduction in the mid-1990s, government officials and ranchers have frequently reached for a gun to cope with livestock problems, killing more than 2,000 wolves by 2013. In 2011, wolves were removed from federal protection under the Endangered Species Act in Idaho, Montana, and parts of Washington, Oregon, and Utah. Wyoming got a similar stamp of approval in 2012, but a federal judge recently overturned that decision. That has made it easier to shoot wolves. Idaho and Montana now even allow recreational hunting, but there have never been any large-scale studies of whether killing wolves really helps to protect livestock. Enter Wilgus. He has a track record for turning controversial wisdom on its head when it comes to attempts to control predators. In 2008, he made news with research that found shooting cougars led to more attacks on livestock. When mature adults were killed, Wilgus said, less seasoned adolescents moved in and were more likely to kill prey. They were more likely to prey on cows and sheep. After wolves arrived in Washington in 2008, growing to 13 packs by 2013, Wilgus turned his attention to the newest carnivore on the block. He examined 25 years of data on killing of wolves and cases where wolves attacked cattle and sheep in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, the first states where wolves were reintroduced. Wilgus found that when a wolf was killed, the chances of livestock getting killed increased the following year in that state by 5-6% for cattle and 4% for sheep. With each additional wolf killed, the chance of livestock attacks rose further. The trend didn't reverse until more than a quarter of the wolves in the state were killed in a single year. Then livestock losses started to decline. That level of wolf killing happened several times, even while wolves were federally protected under rules that allowed the shooting of wolves that threatened livestock. And it is happening now in Idaho and Montana. Last year, hunters killed 231 wolves in Montana and 356 in Idaho, helping to reduce the population to slightly more than 600 in each state. The Idaho legislature this year created a wolf depredation control board, a move critics say is aimed at pushing wolf numbers down to just above 150, a cutoff that could trigger renewed protection under the Endangered Species Act. Wilgus isn't certain why more livestock die when smaller numbers of wolves are killed, but he suspects it's tied to changes in wolf pack behavior. Packs are led by a male and a female breeding pair. If one or both of those wolves is killed, the pack can break up, giving rise to several breeding pairs and thus an uptick in the wolf population. Livestock losses decline only when enough wolves are killed to overwhelm their ability to keep up through reproduction. The theory fits observations made in and around Yellowstone National Park. Wolf packs inside the park, where wolves aren't shot, are large and complex, with wolves of a variety of ages living together, said Doug Smith, a lead wolf researcher at Yellowstone. Wolf packs elsewhere tend to be just a breeding pair and pups. For Wilgus, the upshot of his study is that while killing a wolf may sometimes be necessary, as a routine practice, it's counterproductive and unsustainable. Either livestock losses go up, or if enough wolves are killed to reduce livestock deaths, wolf numbers eventually drop so low that wolves wind up being back on the endangered species list. If the killing slows to less than 25% of the wolf population per year, his studies suggest depredation rates shoot back up. It's a bit of a catch-22, Wilgus said. You can reduce them now, but you can only reduce them so far, and when you stop that heavy harvest, you're at a maximum livestock depredation. Reaction to the new study was split down predictable fault lines. Wolf conservationists pointed to it as evidence that shooting wolves to save livestock doesn't usually make sense. You have this very archaic paradigm of kill first, ask questions later, said Suzanne Stone, senior Northwest representative for the environmental group Defenders of Wildlife. Overall, people in the livestock industry are still pretty rigid in their views that the only way to deal with predators is to kill them, and that's not true. It actually works against them. Stone has run a program with sheep growers in One Idaho Valley aimed at finding ways for sheep and wolves to coexist. The ranchers there resort to a number of tactics to protect roughly 30,000 sheep, monitoring the wolves to avoid grazing the sheep near denning sites, using guard dogs, flashing bright lights to scare off wolves, stringing wire hung with small strips of fabric around the flock at night, and increasing the number of people herding the animals. Stone said the program is cheaper than dispatching a gunman in a helicopter. Fewer than 30 sheep have been lost to wolves in 7 years, and no wolves have been killed. Stan Boyd, executive director of the Idaho Wool Growers Association, said his group works with members to help them deter wolves without shooting the animals. But he still sees guns as critical tools and says wolf populations have declined recently as the number of Idaho wolves has gone down. Wolves get into livestock, we kill wolves, and that works well, Boyd said. The professor can say whatever he wants. We're not going to just let wolves run wild. In Washington State, the state's Department of Fish and Wildlife, which paid for Wilgus's research, is waiting for him to complete a broader examination of all options for managing wolves, said John Pierce, the department's chief wildlife scientist. In the long run, we definitely would prefer to do non-lethal removal if we can figure out how to do that, Pierce said. Meanwhile, all eyes are on the huckleberry pack in the aftermath of the shooting of the lead female. Will fewer sheep die in wolf attacks? Or more. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM. You can also listen to a rebroadcast of this show tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on Free Radio. If you're in the Moscow, Idaho area, tune in to KRFP 90.3 FM, 9:30 p.m. on Monday nights. Or listen to Free Radio Edmonton, YEG Radio at WordPress.com. That's YEG Radio at WordPress.com. The rebroadcasts are on 2 p.m. on Saturdays and 10 a.m. on Sundays, Mountain Time. Or you could go to RadioForAll.net. There you can listen online or download previous Earth First updates. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio News and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.